Well, for quite some time, we've been telling you they're coming, they're coming, they're coming, and they came. Yes, yesterday, the UPS man looking rather haggard. Actually, we helped the UPS man out, the first of 15 cases of the God who justifies coming off of the truck and piled on that two-wheeler and dragged in here. And many, many thanks to those who helped, especially Katie Baker and Summer White. My own daughter was in there stuffing stuff and wrapping stuff. And Rich Pierce had done a brilliant job in getting things lined out. And my right hand worked very hard in signing books as we were getting them out. In fact, we processed about 200 books in just a couple of hours. And in fact, some of you who had in fact already ordered the book in priority mail, we got most of them out, I think, yesterday. So they're on their way to you. The God Who Justifies is now going to be hitting. Well, I was going to say hitting bookstore shelves, and I started thinking about the condition of the Christian bookstore industry and realized that that was a stupid thing to say, actually. Stop laughing out there. I can hear you. in reality, they're going to start hitting websites and like our website and things like that, and hopefully get into a lot of folks, a lot of pastors' offices and libraries, and hopefully it'll be very, very useful to them. So it is available, and maybe next week or sometime after that, I'm not really sure, we can take a look at the book. Maybe once the book gets out, the initial shipping takes place, we can have a time when you all can call in and you can look at, you know, talk about the book, ask some questions about the book, whatever it might be. Maybe we can do something like that in the future. Today we're going to be finishing up. Yes, I did say finishing up. Some of you are very, very concerned that I am going to be doing this response to Norman Geisler's New Appendix for the rest of my adult life. And if we looked at every single error, I almost could. That is how horrifically bad this response is. In fact, as I was sitting here, I honestly wanted to have the new main page article up on the website before the program began today. But what the new main page article, and I hope to get it up within an hour or so after the program is over today when I have an opportunity to try to do it, what the main page article will be is it'll be, it's about 13 pages long right now, written response to the appendix. It's now appendix number 13, which of course is, I think, somewhat appropriate, in the second edition of Chosen But Free. Then it will link to the notes, basically, the read-along notes that I have used so far in the response. And that's 25 pages long. So there will be 37 pages. And this is, when I'm talking pages here, I'm talking not double-spaced or typesized or something like that, full 8.5 by 11 pages. There will be about 37 pages worth of material that I'll be uploading to the website and then linking to the materials at straightgate.com, the three dividing lines that we've done in response to this. So there'll be a lot of information available. You'll be able to both read and hear it. But as I was doing that, I needed to finish up some stuff, needed to fix some things up in the notes section, the 25-page thing that I've been using while doing the programs. And there were a couple paragraphs I had not taken apart and looked up every reference in yet. So as I was doing that, I again started encountering so much ridiculous stuff that I was, again, beating my head on the wall. I cannot believe this is in print. Gail Ripplinger lives, and she's left the King James only camp, and she's moved into the mainstream. It's just incredible. I'm looking at this. Well, here's what I put in the, this will be in the main page article. Let me just read it to you so you can see what I'm talking about. One of the saddest examples of the methodology of this review is found near the end of the appendix on page 262. It seems the author, and then I put parentheses S, author or authors, because I am fully convinced that this was done by an undergraduate student somewhere, or more likely, in fact, by a class project. And let me stop for a moment and say why I think that. Not only, as I was working through stuff this week and putting together the main page article, two things struck me at the same time, and together I went, this is interesting. The first thing was the fact that as I put together the documentation on the incredible misuse of a single phrase, the phrase was mere presentation. Twice in this article, this phrase, mere presentation, is used to beat me over the head, to say that I engaged in ad hominem argumentation. It's used in two completely, in fact, contradictory ways by the authors of this particular review. And as I was thinking about that, and I've talked about this before, it'll be in the webpage, it's where I was actually affirming the sufficiency of Scripture, saying that the mere presentation of God's truth from the Word is sufficient for the child of God. That misuse of the phrase in two different ways indicates to me, well, you know, if only one person was writing this, wouldn't they remember that they had already accused me of engaging in ad hominem based upon this before? This looks a lot like what you'd get out of a group project where you have one group over here, you do this aspect of the book, and one group over there, you do this aspect of the book, or you do the first 100 pages and you do the next 100 pages, something along those lines. Or here's what someone did on an initial reading, pass that around the room, and you, this group over there, you work on this paragraph, and you guys over here, you come up with allegations that this guy doesn't know what he's talking about in this area, whatever it might be. That's what it looked like to me. And then I remembered something. A little over a year ago, a radio personality contacted me and relayed to me a conversation, a 20-minute conversation, that he had with Norman Geisler about me. And one of the things that Dr. Geisler said to him was that he was going to use the Potter's Freedom in his logic classes as a textbook of how not to do logic, a textbook of how to identify bad logical errors. And all of a sudden it hit me. Why is this so bad? Why are there page citations that are wrong? Why is it that anything that I've said about anything, doesn't matter what the original context was, the original context of Potter's Freedom is absolutely, positively irrelevant to the author or authors of this appendix. It does not matter at all. How could that have happened? It would have happened if this was a class project. And so that's why throughout the material I'm going to be posting on the web today, I use author parentheses S. So if it's one guy or it's a number of people, whatever, that's what I'm talking about. So I'm talking about one of the saddest examples of the methodology of this review, page 262 in the second edition of Chosen But Free. And I continue. It seems the authors of this review felt it would be best to include their worst examples of miscitation, misreading, and simple error in the midst of personal attacks. So we have an entire subsection titled Pride and Exclusivism, which begins, and now I'm quoting from page 262 of Chosen But Free. Quote, I am not alone in detecting a proud and exclusivistic undertone in Potter's Freedom. For example, it calls its view the Reformed view, page 38, emphasis added, while summarily dismissing other Reformed theologians, CBF cites, who do not agree with major points in its presentation, for example, William Shedd and R.T. Kendall. The author of Potter's Freedom immodestly announces, quote, I will be demonstrating, end quote, that Geisler's view, quote, is in error, end quote, page 30. Better to set forth one's case and let the reader decide that. And that is the end of the quotation from Chosen But Free. Now, I then comment. One has to wonder who these nameless, faceless people are who join with the authors in detecting this pride. I detected lots of feelings I could have mentioned in regard to Dr. Geisler's book, but you do not present such things unless you can back up what you are saying. But the great irony is that in the midst of accusing me of being prideful, the authors of this review purposefully misrepresent me and give clear evidence of their desire to do so. How so? Note the second to last quoted line above, which reads, and here's the line you need to hear. The author of Potter's Freedom immodestly announces, quote, I will be demonstrating, and then there is a closed quote, that Geisler's view, quote, is in error, quote, close, page 30. When I first read this, I only noted that it is hardly immodest to say that one's view is in error, unless, of course, that person does not believe you intelligent enough, or old enough, or trained enough to even critique their position. But as I was finishing up my notes on the response, I looked up the actual context of the citation and again groaned in unbelief at what I found. Here is the context from the Potter's Freedom. So where is this phrase coming from? This phrase that I will be demonstrating that Geisler's view is in error and that this is immodest and arrogant and so on and so forth. Where does this come from? Well, here's the actual full quotation from the Potter's Freedom. The Reformed tradition is rich in honest dialogue and debate. Those who love truth will not be offended by honest, direct refutation and interaction. The politically correct culture we live in should not be allowed to silence meaningful theological debate. Dr. Geisler himself has written, quote, Third, what about those who insist that drawing lines will divide Christians? In response, it must be lovingly but firmly maintained that it is better to be divided by truth than to be united by error. There is an unhealthy tendency in evangelical Christianity to hide under the banner of Christian charity while sacrificing doctrinal purity. That's the end of the quote from Dr. Geisler, and then I continued in The Potter's Freedom. In the spirit of these words, I offer a rebuttal of Dr. Geisler's work. This is not meant to be a presentation of the Reformed view, so ably accomplished by others. My positive presentation will be limited to establishing facts that are not in evidence from a reading of Chosen But Free. Instead, I will be demonstrating that the biblical argumentation provided by Norman Geisler is in error. It is my hope that the reader will be edified by the consistent focus upon biblical exegesis, for this is truly the heart and soul of Reformed theology. There is the quotation. I continue in the web article that will be posted later this afternoon. As I compared the citation to the original, I could not help but be amazed at the use of the quotation marks in CBF. Here, we cannot blame eyesight. We cannot blame a simple misreading of the text. This is purposeful and planned. I said I would demonstrate that the biblical argumentation provided by Norman Geisler is in error. I continued on, you may note, in talking about biblical exegesis. And that's exactly what I did in the book. 28 scholars and pastors whose names are found on the Potter's Freedom, and hundreds of others who have contacted me since then, agree that I did just that. The fact that Dr. Geisler does not even attempt a response on an exegetical level gives eloquent testimony that I did exactly what I promised to do. But that is not what is quoted in the new appendix to Chosen But Free. No, through the purposeful and fascinating use of quotation marks, the actual substance of my statement, focused upon biblical argumentation, is deleted. And Geisler's entire view, his entire theology, is placed in its stead. This then becomes the basis of the accusation of pride and arrogance on my part. How could a young, overzealous, arrogant, prideful, at times pedantic apologist like James White dare to say he will prove Dr. Norman Geisler's entire viewpoint in error? How brash! But of course, the original citation could not be used without deleting its substance. How strange would it look to accuse me of being prideful simply for saying and proving someone else's biblical argumentation is in error? Can the biblical argumentation provided by two sides who contradict one another both be correct? Well, of course not, and even Dr. Geisler well recognizes that fact, and is it not the case that one of his greatest claims to fame is his books written against others who claim to be Christians, saying their views are in error? Hence, it follows of necessity that the quotation, to be useful to the appendix, had to be spun and changed. So it was, and such is simply disgraceful. It's absolutely disgraceful. And I ran across that right before the program started. And then I continued on. As it continues to beat me over the head for being prideful and exclusivistic. It then says, it claims my position is utterly without substantiation and that its own conclusion is true without question. That's the assertion of Dr. Geisler in Chosen But Free. It claims my position, that's Dr. Geisler's position, is utterly without substantiation, page 262 of the Potter's Freedom, and that its own conclusion is true without question. Now, of course, again, it's presented as if this is some broad sweeping assertion, that I'm saying that his entire position is utterly without substantiation, that there's no argument whatsoever that's put forward or something like that, and that I'm saying of myself that my own conclusions are without question true. That's what it sounds like it's saying. But as normal, throughout this text, throughout this review, context is utterly ignored. So when you go to page 262 of the Potter's Freedom, what are we talking about here? Well, we're dealing with the subject of particular redemption, and in fact, we are talking here about John Calvin's view, because if you're new to our program, haven't heard this before, Geisler takes the most unusual position that he identifies his inconsistent Arminianism as moderate Calvinism by redefining the T in tulip, the U, rejecting the L, rejecting the I and redefining it and embracing the P. He calls this Arminianism, this inconsistent Arminianism, moderate Calvinism, and he calls historic Calvinism, historic Reform theology, extreme Calvinism. And it's extreme because, according to him, John Calvin certainly, and he uses that term, certainly rejected limits of atonement, that he certainly believed in universal atonement. He doesn't make it a, well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. He says John Calvin certainly did, therefore if you hold to limits of atonement, you are beyond Calvin, and therefore you are an extreme Calvinist. And so that's what's being discussed. And what I did on page 260, starting all the way back, page 259. I provide extensive quotations from John Calvin on this very issue. And then I noted something that a number of people, especially those of you who have interest in historical things, already did note. Let me just read this to you, because this is somewhat interesting. A lot of people have a lot of interest in this. Starting on page 260, if this interpretation of all men is read into the passages cited from Calvin, however, it becomes plain that Calvin did not hold the unlimited view of the atonement that CBF claims. As to the word world, Calvin's view is exemplified by his comments on 1 John 2:2. This passage is quoted by CBF, yet for some reason, it seems as if CBF, and hey, look at that, I found a typographical error. It is seems. Ha ha, I found a typographical, hey, someone else didn't find it, I found it for myself. Someone circle that thing so we can get that fixed. It seems as if CBF thinks this quotation affirms a universal view of the atonement. It is highly educational to note that Dr. Geisler inserted a whole series of italics into his rendition of Calvin's words. Why is it educational? Because he emphasizes the portions that seem to support his thesis, but ignores the direct statements that contradict him. I should have seen this coming, huh? Go back to page 261. Calvin scholars, for centuries, have cited this passage as evidence of Calvin's particularism. But note how Geisler cites the passage. Now, it's a little bit hard. Do this because I don't want to go italics start, italics close, but I guess it's the only way I can do it to try to communicate this to you. It's a whole lot easier to read this. He puts this in for amplification, that believers might be convinced that, italics, the expiation made by Christ extends to all who by faith embrace the gospel, italics close. But here the question may be asked as to, italics, how the sin of the whole world, sins of the whole world have been expiated, italics closed. I pass over the dreams of the fanatics who make this a reason to extend salvation to all the reprobate and even to Satan himself. Such a monstrous idea is not worth refuting. Those who want to avoid this absurdity have said that, italics, Christ suffered sufficiently for the whole world, but effectively only for the elect. Italics end. This solution has commonly prevailed in the schools. Although, italics, I allow for the truth of this, italics closed, I deny that it fits this passage. That phrase is not italicized. For John's purpose was only to make this blessing common to the whole church. Therefore, under the word all, as in 1 John 2:2, he does not include the reprobate, but refers to all who would believe and those who were scattered through the various regions of the earth. For, as is meet, the grace of Christ is really made clear when it is declared to be the only salvation of the world, comments on 1 John 2:2. Dr. Geisel then provides this interpretation. Calvin clearly denies universalism and affirms the sufficiency of Christ's death for the whole world, even though he denies that this particular passage can be used to teach this. And I then comment on his assertion. There is a clear error being committed here by Dr. Geisler. If he wished to italicize the important element of the quote, he would have italicized this comment, therefore, under the word all in 1 John 2:2, he does not include the reprobate, but refers to all who would believe and those who were scattered through various regions of the earth. This is the key affirmation. Here, Calvin completely contradicts Dr. Geisler's interpretation. In fact, as we will see below, CBF identifies the idea expressed by Calvin and earlier by Augustine as an obvious case of eisegesis reading into the text that does not deserve an extensive treatment. Further, Geisler italicizes the assertions of others rather than Calvin, yet then interprets these as being Calvin's view. Calvin believes John's assertion is meant to give confidence to all believers that Christ is their propitiation, but that this does not mean that Christ's death is offered for the reprobate. If we interpret this in Calvin's context, his words are clear. It is without question his assertion that when John says the whole world, he is saying this does not include the reprobate. This means he does not believe Christ died for every single human being. Dr. Geisler italicizes the statement of the schoolmen about the sacrifice being sufficient for the world but efficient for the elect, despite the fact that Calvin denies this is the meaning of the passage. In conclusion, then, we see that the assertion that Calvin certainly denied limited atonement, and that this means that those who hold this view are extreme Calvinists, is utterly without substantiation, either in Calvin's words or in the readily available scholarly sources. There is the end of my quotation. Now, that last paragraph that I read to you is at the end of a section on Calvin's view of the atonement that begins on page 253, and that is found on page 262. So there's 10 pages. 10 full pages of argumentation, 10 full pages of citations, 10 full pages of material from other scholars on this particular subject, and the last, final, concluding statement is, in conclusion then, we see the assertion that Calvin certainly denied limited atonement, certainly is in quotes, by the way, because that's exactly what he says, and that this means that those who hold this view are extreme Calvinists, is utterly without substantiation, either in Calvin's words or in the readily available scholarly sources. So I concluded that. That was the assertion that I made. Now, when we look back at the appendix, we have the sentence, it claims my position. My position about what? Well, in context, he would have had to have said, it claims that my assertion that Calvin certainly believed in universal atonement is, quote, utterly without substantiation, page 262. That is the only scholarly way that that phrase could be used. If you take it out of its context, if you apply it in a general context, you are misrepresenting the original source. It claims our position is utterly without substantiation and that its own conclusion is true without question. And so I started looking for, where did I say that my conclusion on Calvin's view of the atonement was true without question? So I started looking through the page, and if you've got the book, you might look through the page yourself. And I started looking through the page. I finally found it. Do you know where the author, the scholarly author of this review, gets the statement, and that its own conclusion is true without question? Well, it was the preceding paragraph. Let's find it again here. Further, Geiser italicizes the assertions of others rather than Calvin, yet then interprets these as being Calvin's view. Calvin believes John's assertion is meant to give confidence to all believers that Christ is their propitiation, but that this does not mean that Christ's death is offered for the reprobate. If we interpret this in Calvin's context, his words are clear. It is without question his assertion that when John says the whole world, he is saying this does not include the reprobate. There's the phrase. Without question. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the specifics of Calvin's interpretation of 1 John 2:2, and specifically that he's saying that it's not, the sacrifice of Christ was not for the reprobate. And yet that, it seems, it's cut and paste time, folks. Any phrase, any words whatsoever, it does not matter where they occur. It does not matter what I intended them to communicate. You can pull them out and put them together with other ones and go, oh, look, he's a mean, prideful little person. It's incredible. I have, honestly, Gail Ripplinger could learn from this. She really could, because she's not very good at it. I'm just absolutely, positively amazed. Just absolutely amazed at this kind of incredible misuse of the English language. Just unbelievable. Well, we're going to take your phone calls today. Because I'm going to, you've been listening for 2 weeks now. Maybe there's some of you who are... Maybe there's some of you who are big Norm Geisler fans, and you just think I have been terrible and horrible. I would like to invite anyone. I'd like to invite Norm Geisler to call in. But anyone who would like to attempt to take up his defense, I've got a lot of questions for you. And maybe you just like to comment on this and vent your utter frustration as well. 866-854-6763. 866-854-6763. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Dividing Line. My name is James White, waiting for the phone lines to start melting under the heat of all your calls at 866-854-6763. Looking for, certainly, I would like to give priority to anyone who would like to say that, well, actually, Dr. Geiser's right, and here's the excuse, here's the explanation for why the original context of what you said is irrelevant, that you should be fair in bending over backwards to make sure that when you quote Dr. Geiser, you need to quote him in context and exactly with what he's saying, but... chosen but free does not have to worry at all about what you were saying. You don't have to quote in context because you're too young. You can't possibly know enough to even disagree with Dr. Geisler. You should have kept your nose out of this in the first place, etc., etc., etc. Maybe you just like to say, no, I do have an explanation for exactly why Dr. Geisler is right. 866-854-6763 is the number. And maybe you would just like to comment on what you have heard over the past few weeks. I think there's a lot of folks that just simply sits, that you just sit there and you go, you've got to be kidding me. How did this get into print? I don't know. I can't, I cannot explain how this got into print outside of the fact that when someone such as Dr. Geisler, who's written 40 or 50 books, submits something to his publisher, the assumption is that he knows what he's talking about, and that there's not going to be any examination of it on that level. And I do not in any way, shape, or form hold Bethany House accountable for this at all. They're my publisher. They've been great to me. The God Who Justifies, it just came out. It's from Bethany House. They did a great job. I do not believe there is any knowledge whatsoever on the part of the editorial staff or anybody else about how bad this was. I do not think it is their job to sit there and go get my book and sit there and look up these references. And I would imagine that those who are, if there is anyone doing that, are sitting there absolutely shaking their heads in the exact same way that I am, going, what is this? There is only one person ultimately accountable for this, and that is Dr. Norman Geisler. It's his book. It's got his name on it. And I don't care if he did farm it out to somebody else, and I don't care if he is busy. It's his responsibility. It's his book. And so fundamentally, he's the one that has to answer the question, why couldn't you get page numbers right? Why can't you allow any context whatsoever to be even slightly relevant? Why are there quotations where you used quotation marks to change the meaning? What's with all this ad hominem? What's going on here? Why did you do this? He's the only one that can answer that question. And so that question needs to be asked of him. 866-854-6763 if you would like to join with the discussion today. Let me read you another section of what's going to be on the webpage today. It is a section titled, Where's the Exegesis? I tried to come up with something to be like, where's the beef? But not only is that old now, but I really couldn't fit exegesis with anything that was related to beef in any way, shape, or form. The vast majority of this response should never have seen the light of day. Given the character of the Potter's Freedom as an exegetical reply to Chosen But Free, the logical response would involve exegetical rebuttal and argument. But, of course, this is exactly what is avoided by this reply. No exegesis of any disputed passage is offered. No exegesis of the many passages the original book simply forgot were relevant is provided. One brief section, subtitled Improper Exegesis, at least raises the issue of the interpretation of the text, but it is tremendously surface level and simply says, and I quote, here's the entirety of the exegetical element. Here's improper exegesis, one paragraph. As readers of Potter's Freedom can detect for themselves, the author is convinced of his exegetical skills and chides CBF for its alleged lack thereof. Yet Potter's Freedom repeatedly reads some men into passages that clearly and emphatically say all men, pages 140 and 142. It insists against the context that 2 Peter 3:9, where God desires that all men to be saved, is not speaking about salvation. It claims that John 1:12-13 does not say received when the very word is used by John in this text. It overlooks the context that speaks of unrepentant people, Romans 9:22, claiming Romans 9 affirms that the only difference between vessels of wrath and vessels of mercy is God's action. It distorts the word saves to saves himself, page 64, and so on. That's what it says. That's actually a part of the quote, and so on, which is another one of the reasons I sort of have to sit back and go, man, this sounds like something somebody else put together. It's just sort of jumbled together, and so on. Unreal. Well, how do we respond to this? Well, the Potter's Freedom contains literally hundreds of pages of positive exegetical presentation, and this is the extent of the response offered to it. The Potter's Freedom documents dozens of examples of eisegesis on the part of Dr. Geisler. This is all the response that can be given? And even in offering these few sentences, the appendix stumbles over itself in making clear errors yet once again. Note the first allegation. Without responding to a single argument or point of exegesis, this response simply asserts that I must be wrong in my understanding of the term all. But since I provide contextual and linguistic arguments that are completely ignored, how can this be called a meaningful or scholarly response? Not only that, but just going back and leaving the webpage article, in fact, I may expand this part. I better stop expanding or it's get too big. Specifically, it says here that I insisted against the context that 2 Peter 3:9 is not speaking about salvation. I didn't say that. I said in 2 Peter 3:9 that it's talking about the elect of God. and that the parousia has been delayed so that all of the elect of God can be gathered in. It doesn't even accurately summarize in one sentence the argument that it's then completely closing its eyes to and ignoring. Unbelievable. It claims that John 1, 12 through 13 does not say received when the very word is used by John in this text, page 185. Well, by now you've probably started figuring out exactly what's going on here, right? When we go to page 185, we can probably start predicting that in reality, we're not going to find anything on page 185 that substantiates Geisler's assertion, right? In fact, we're probably going to find exegesis that would have to be responded to but has been ignored, right? Well, you would be exactly right. That's exactly what's going on. Here's the quotation. But the objection does raise an interesting issue. Does the text itself indicate a relationship between believing and the new birth? There are certainly some points that Dr. Geisler would have to consider to make his assertion carry weight. Number one, John, as is his custom, refers to Christians as the believing ones, tois pisteuousin. English translations normally miss this important element of John's gospel, the contrast between true, saving faith, which is almost always expressed through the use of the present tense indicating an ongoing living faith, versus false faith, which is almost always placed in the aorist tense, making no statement about its consistency or vitality. It is literally, even to those who are believing in his name, or the believing ones who believe in his name. The term believing is a present participle. The verb born is the aorist passive form. In its context, it is plainly said to be an act of God. All human agency is denied. Number three, it follows then that verse 13 is a description of the believing ones of verse 12. Nothing is said in the text that the new birth is received by an act of free will. In fact, the exact opposite is stated clearly, the ones born not of the will of man. It is an amazing example of how preconceived notions can be read into a text that chosen but free can say the text makes the new birth dependent upon an act of free will when the text says the opposite. Now, in case you got lost for various reasons, let me just repeat that last section because here's the basis of it. In the new edition of Chosen But Free, the assertion is made that I, in my writings, assert. The quote is, it claims that John 1, 12 through 13 does not say received when the very word is used by John in this text. Well, is that what I said? Did I say the word received does not appear in John chapter 1, verses 12 through 13? No, I didn't, did I? Point three was, it follows then that verse 13 is a description of the believing ones of verse 12. Nothing is said in the text that the new birth is received by an act of free will. In fact, the exact opposite is stated clearly, the ones born not of the will of man. It is an amazing example of how preconceived notions can be read into a text that CBF can say the text makes the new birth dependent upon an act of free will when the text says the opposite. That's what I said. How can anyone read that and say, you're saying the word received isn't in the text? No, the sentence is, in fact, nothing is said in the text that the new birth is received by an act of free will. Now, how can that be misread that way? I don't know. I've given up. I can't figure it out. I cannot figure it out. But that's exactly what it has done. 866-854-6763. I'm going to begin to sing. If those of you who have been making comments concerning this issue, maybe I have just absolutely nailed it to the floor and everybody goes, well, you know, that's it. This is a bad review, and you don't care. Maybe that's why. I don't know. But 866-854-6763, anyone who would like to defend Dr. Geisler in this appendix, you are more than welcome to call in. Everybody's going, yeah, right, sure, someone's going to call in and talk to you about Dr. Geisler's appendix and defend him. Sure, they're going to do that. Yeah, right, uh-huh. And we're all voting for Gary Condit next time around. Right, sure. But aside from that, some of you may wish to call in and say, hey, you know, this is incredible. Maybe this is the reason, or maybe this illustrates this. Whatever it might be, 854-6763. Let me go ahead and tell you how I finish the web article. Here's what I say. The concluding section is called Drop Back 10 and Punt. Those who need point-by-point response can do so by clicking here. Obviously, what that means is maybe James just gives us the phone numbers too fast. Okay, let me try this. 6-6. Oh, by the way, it's on the title bar of the chat room there, whoever just said that. 866-854-6763. Okay. Sometimes the comments made in the chat room are just so utterly distracting. Anyways, there surely is no reason to drag. Oh, what I'm saying is that when I put it up there, there's going to be a hyperlink inserted at that point, and all my notes are going to be able to, you can just go right to the notes that I've been using and read those. That's where it's going to be like 37 pages worth of stuff here. There surely is no reason to drag this particularly painful experience out much further. All who have benefited from the work of Norman Geisler in the past cannot help but feel a true sense of embarrassment at the publication of this response. I am actually thankful that I am the object of this review, for if it had been offered in response to enemies of the faith, they would have known no bounds to their joyous documentation of its every error and would have used this as an argument against everything good that Dr. Geisler has written. At the end of this review, Dr. Geisler says he prays that I will channel my, quote, considerable talent and zeal toward the more pressing need of defending Christianity against deny the fundamentals of the faith, not those who affirm them, end quote. While this may sound like a noble sentiment, I have to wonder, why did Dr. Geisler write Chosen But Free? Why did he choose to identify the faith of Reformed Baptist churches, conservative Presbyterian churches, and many others as irrational and unbiblical? Are we to understand that he has the right to do this, but those of us at the pointed end of his sword must ignore his highly errant and flawed attacks upon our faith? I honestly do not understand the basis of such a statement. One thing is beyond all doubt. This response proves even more clearly than did the text of the Potter's Freedom that Dr. Geisler has no response to Reformed scholarship. In closing, I would like to ask Dr. Geisler to consider well the nature of this appendix. As I have said, I do not believe he wrote it. I believe someone else, perhaps even a group, cooperated in piecing together disparate and inconsistent comments on the text of the book. But whatever its provenance, it exists today as part of the second edition of Chosen But Free, and the front of the book says, Norman Geisler. That places the above documented errors, a word that seems extremely weak to cover the kind of misrepresentations we have seen, squarely in his realm of responsibility. And hence I will say with all seriousness, Dr. Geisler, do the right thing. Pull this appendix, print a retraction, and simply do what is right. You do not attack any fellow believer with such terms as arrogant, overzealous, pedantic, and prideful while utilizing this kind of utterly inane misrepresentation and argumentation as a shield. It is simply scholarly negligence. Unless Dr. Geisler can explain how this kind of material has some relevance to the actual topic at hand, it should be pulled from circulation with apologies to all concerned, but especially to his own readers. There simply is no other course to follow. That's how I conclude the review, by calling upon Dr. Geisler to pull this review and print a retraction. There simply is no other course of action open to any person who is honest. That is how bad this response is. And we've proven it. We've documented it. We've been very careful to do so. Unlike the review, we have quoted everything in context. You can look up the page numbers. Our page numbers happen to be correct. You can look them up for yourself. Dr. Geisler, you only have one choice. Do the right thing. Well, 866-854-6763. I'm taking the new edition of Chosen But Free. It's going up there on top of, what is this book anyways? Rome and the African Church in the Time of Augustine by J.E. Merdinger. You know how expensive that was? I think it was about $45. Every time I have to buy these Roman Catholic books, they are so expensive. In fact, I've got one up here. My office is a mess. It's underneath the Hebrew lexicon here. Origins of Papal Infallibility, 1150 to 1350, a study on the concepts of infallibility, sovereignty, and tradition in the Middle Ages by Brian Tierney, published by E.J. Brill. You know how much this cost? $105, not including shipping. And I'm looking at it here, and it's 75 pages shorter than The God Who Justifies. Someone ought to figure out the numbers. The percentage cheaper. The God Who Justifies over Tierney stuff. All of Tierney's stuff is expensive. He's a good scholar, got a lot of good stuff. It's worth it, I guess. You got to have that kind of stuff. Well, anyways, I put that away. I'm putting the Potter's Freedom over here on top of where I keep my books. You have to put it there. I don't want to knock down the digital camera that's over there. I'm in book writing mode, so my office is a mess. Absolute mess. And the sad thing is, I have not been able to get it cleaned up for quite some time because I'd normally clean it up between book writing projects. There is no between book writing projects anymore. And therefore, the office is a complete and total mess. Oh, look at what's in my hand now. Hey, AO man, watch it. I have in my hand the current edition. You know, we haven't mentioned this. So since no one wants to talk about the Potter's Freedom, fine, that's cool with me. I can understand. Y'all just don't want to talk about these things. I hold in my hand the current edition of the Christian Research Journal. This is volume 23, number 4 from the year 2001. And why do I have this in my hand? Well, it is not for the cover. Anyone who wants to see, if you don't get the Christian Research Journal, I would recommend it to you. It's well worth getting. I'm one of the, what do they call me? I'm not really sure what my title is. I mean, it's not really a title, but they do list. Folks who are, there it is, contributing writers now. It used to be a contributing something other, but contributing writers. And isn't it funny that both Norm Geisler and I are listed? hey, Charles Stromer is listed. How'd Charles Stromer get in there? Is that the same guy? Like the senator or something? Charles Stromer has written for the Christian Research Journal? Very, very interesting. Anyways, I write for the Christian Research Journal, and there is a two-part... Oh, Charles Schumer. Oh. what can I say? there's a two-part debate that is being printed in the Christian Research Journal, And the first part of the debate appears in this edition, and the second part, Lord willing, will appear in the second edition if we can find the person that I am debating, who seemingly has disappeared, for the final corrections to his material. And so what we have here is the debate entitled The Divine Sovereignty Human Responsibility Debate by James R. White and George Bryson. Mr. Bryson is high up in the Calvary Chapel movement. And the first two opening statements and first two rebuttals are found in this edition of the CRI Journal. The next two will be in the next one. And I think it's well worth reading. I will be very honest with you. I don't understand what Mr. Bryson's saying. I just don't get it. But anyways, I did make a comment about the cover, and I've told Elliot Miller this. So I don't think there's going to be too many folks who are going to disagree with me on this one. The front. Go to equipped.org if you want to see this cover. If you don't get it, go to equipped.org. Check out this cover. It is a drawing of Oprah Winfrey. But it's really hard to even describe this because the entire cover is nothing but her face. And there's nothing, there's no border. So it's just smack dab up against, it's huge. And it's orange. And it's, well, I'll tell you, it's hideous. That's what it is. It's absolutely hideous. It honestly sort of looks like Oprah was walking toward a camera, tripped, fell, and smacked her face right against the camera lens, and that's what you'd get. That's the only way I can describe it. It is absolutely, positively hideous. And even when I keep it here on my desk, I keep it backside up, because it's hideous. But, get it anyways and, take off the cover, do something, I don't know. Get it anyways because it could be an interesting debate, that we're going to have. So anyways, I'll tell you what, we have all of one caller so far. I truly, truly appreciate that one brave person. Who has not called, however, to talk about Chosen But Free and the Potter's Freedom, which is fine. That's okay. We will. She's melting. Someone in the chat channel just looked at the cover. And she's melting. Well, look, you can't really see it, but if you actually have the CRI Journal, if you looked on page, there it is. I suppose I should have some paper back here. I can go like certain famous people. There's page 12, page 13. You'll see this is illustrated by Tom Fluharty, Fluharty. And all I can say to Tom, who illustrated this article, do not run into Oprah in a dark alley. Okay? Because she gonna take you out, so that's just all there is to it. It's just, oh man, there's a blue one on page 12. Is that supposed to be Oprah? On page 12, is that really supposed to be? That looks like one of, you know who that looks like? That looks like the angel dude in that one original Star Trek. That his face got all. He was that famous attorney. What was that guy's name? I'll bet you someone in the chat room is going to know this. He was a famous attorney, and he appeared on Star Trek as this angel sort of alien dude that had did some of these kids or something or whatever. And it turned out he was. That's what it looks like. That cannot be Oprah. That's not possible. I can't remember who it was. Someone will tell me during the break because we need to take a break. And as you can tell, I'm just babbling on anyway. So we're going to take our first phone call. Maybe our only phone call. Who knows? And if the phone call doesn't go long enough, I will start singing. So you can call at 866-854-6763. If you want to stop this, we'll be right back. that break was not long enough because I didn't finish my Mrs. Fields semi-sweet chocolate chip cookie. Man, those are good. Oh, and I can't reach my water either. The trials. What am I going to sing? Everyone's asking what... You didn't really. You really didn't have to come in here to do that. I could. Thank you very much, though. Yep, yeah, well, thank you. Wonderful. Well, I'll tell you. A true doulos there. what am I going to sing? I don't know. I'll take requests. You know, I like A Mighty Fortress. I think A Mighty Fortress is really good. So you all can, yeah, we'll take some requests and see what we can do. And by the way, I should mention this. Anyone in the chat channel who leaves before I start singing, I log everything. I will note the times, and you will be kickmanned. So you're going to have to listen. Now, I know I can't control whether you're still listening, but anyways, Aomin has his Steve Camp CD standing by. Well, I've got a few CDs standing by, too. I've got a Cademan's Call CD and stuff like that. You know, if we need to go to music, we can go to music. What can we say? Anyways, we do have a brave caller who has called in. And, oh, brave caller, dost thou wish to defend the mighty Norman Geisler?
Oh, I don't know about that one.
You do not wish to do so?
No, sir.
No? Oh. Do you want me to sing?
I've never heard you sing, but I don't want to torture the guys in the chat channel.
I can hear you in the background there, Rich. That's great. Just join on in. It's okay. It's all right. If you want to do that.
Well, my question is not on Dr. Geisler. It's about the article of the CRI Journal between you and George Bryson.
Yeah, you know what? Before you ask the question, you know, Warenski suggested something to me. Maybe, and this is probably the way it is. On page 12, I'll bet you anything that the purple lady is the author of the article, Kate Maver. And the blue dude, I'll bet you that's Tom Flaherty. I'll bet you the dude who did the illustration put himself in there, and maybe that's his way of saying, hey, don't get mad at me. I did it to myself. And you see, what's supposed to be going on here is that Oprah over here in the corner, the other hideous thing there, it sort of looks like her face just sort of like got splattered like the cover of an orange onto a flat surface. That's supposed to be the sun, see? And he's like the moon, and these are planets, and that's what's going on there. And that doesn't quite translate onto the cover, but that's what's going on. And that's okay in the article, but the cover, the only term I can come up with is hideous. Absolutely. Ah, ugh. Anyways, I just wanted to mention that because someone had pointed that out to me, and it made sense. So, anyways, yes, Mr. Bryson and I are having a little debate and on the subject of divine sovereignty and human responsibility.
Right, because there was something, see, I know that a lot of those that are opposed to the reform understanding don't necessarily object to calling faith a gift from God. But in this article, Bryson doesn't express that, at least I don't remember as I was reading it. I don't remember him calling it a gift from God, and it almost sounded to me, and I'm looking for the passage where he talks about the reception of grace, faith, and he doesn't call it a gift from God, or he almost makes it sound like we're actually misunderstanding Ephesians 2. And I'm just kind of wondering exactly what his standpoint is on that.
Well, unfortunately, I will be the first person to assert that I don't understand what he's saying. I have I've listened to his Real Audio sermons. I've looked at his book. I've listened to him on radio programs. Tapes were sent to me from a radio appearance he did over the course of a few days over in L.A. And I find George Bryson's expressions on this subject tremendously confusing. And I have had a number of other people read this material, and they look at me and go, huh? So I don't know. I cannot answer that. Now, I know that the citation on page 40 from Calvin's New Testament commentaries,
mm-hmm.
That in regards to Ephesians chapter 2...
Actually, I found the citation.
Okay.
It says, if faith is the means to receive the gift of eternal life and salvation, it should not be confused with that gift as it is in Calvinism, on page 40.
Right, that's exactly what I was about to look at in the quotation from Calvin that is above that. And by the way, I'm not sure why, but I can hear the folks on the other side of the wall coming through my headphones over a microphone somehow. I'm not sure how it's happening, but I thought I would let them know that so that they could be very guarded in what they are saying. First of all, he's misunderstanding what Calvin said here.
Mm-hmm.
If you look up in the Potter's Freedom, I gave an extensive page and a half, almost 2.5 page quotation from Calvin on that, and he's very clear in exactly what he's talking about there. But you're right. If faith is the means to receive the gift of eternal life and salvation, it should not be confused with that gift as it is in Calvinism. So basically what he's saying is, well, if you're saying that faith is a gift and salvation is a gift, then they must both be the same gift, which is not the case at all. All of salvation, including faith, regeneration, adoption as sons, forgiveness of sins, it is all of grace and it's all a gift. He doesn't seem to recognize that what we're talking about is the ability to believe, the result of regeneration, where the slavery to sin that Jesus described in John chapter 8 is broken. The rebellion against God, the fact that we have a heart of stone and not a heart of flesh, that heart of stone is removed, a heart of flesh is given to us, etc., etc. That stuff simply isn't addressed by George Bryson, and it's like part of the problem here, and part of the problem with this debate, I'll be very honest with you, is I can remember very, very clearly in sometime before Christmas of last year, standing in the front yard of my parents' home on my cell phone, talking with George Bryson about how we were going to organize this debate. CRI had contacted me, said we want to do a debate on this. Obviously, you're a logical person to do that. Who should we get for the other side? Well, of course, someone who will remain nameless, that name was raised, but he wasn't interested in doing it. So once George Bryson was chosen, he and I got together, and we talked on the phone. I said, well, we need to have some sort of organization here so that we're talking about the same issues at the same time. And so we had agreed to do the first part on the decree of election and the second part on the will of man. So in essence, start with God's sovereign decree in the first one, and the second one deal with the will of man, the nature of man. Well, as you've probably read it, that's not exactly how it worked out. I did that. That was what my presentation was on. I didn't have anything in my presentation where I focus upon the passages about man's inability and things like that in my presentation. He didn't do that. He sort of did the scattergun, the whole nine yards type approach. Mm-hmm. And so in my rebuttal, all I could do was very briefly mention those things. I have a much fuller presentation, obviously, in 1,800 words anyways, of man's depravity and the nature of saving faith in the next part of the debate. Mm-hmm. But he sort of preemptorily tried to take that out. I don't think that it worked, but that's in essence what's going on. So in the next part of the debate, I focus, as we had agreed when we were on the phone, on the issue of the will of man, the impact of sin, man's deadness in sin, etc., etc.
Mm. So, but you don't know if he's denying that faith is a gift from God.
Well, I think his argument is that faith is the capacity and the ability of every single individual. And that would be very similar to Geisler's view, where if he says that the non-elect person does not have the capacity for faith, that person has been dehumanized, that since faith is something that is commanded, believe and repent, that the ability to believe and the ability to repent must be a natural part of man's capacity, or God is commanding us to do something we cannot do, ignoring, of course, the fact that our inability is due to our own sin. That would be like saying that it's unjust for us to have stoplights because there will be people who are drunk who can't stop. It's unjust of us to command people to do things that they cannot do just because they happen to have consumed 4-6 packs of beer. No, it's not unjust at all. But that's the argument that's used by Norman Geisler and seems to be the argument that's being used here. I'll be honest with you, and I said this in my rebuttal. I don't find Bryson's position at all consistent. His use of terminology is not consistent. He'll say one thing at one point and then go and turn around and contradict himself at another point. So I found it to be a very, very confusing presentation. And I'm just hoping that my presentation plus the opportunity of rebuttal will be useful to folks. And as I said, a lot of people, there's someone in the chat room right now, brilliant, brilliant person, very, very smart, that's just that looked at it and was just like, I don't, what's he saying?
I do understand what he's saying, because just a year ago I used to think that way.
Yeah, well, I understand what the Arminian is saying. What I'm saying is I don't, George Bryson's particular spin on things seems somewhat non-standard. It's certainly not historical Arminianism in the sense of the systematic theologians who were part and parcel of developing that perspective. So it's a little bit different. He'll try to affirm sovereignty and then turn around and say, but that doesn't mean X, Y, or Z. So I know what he's saying, but when he attempts to say, well, I actually agree with some of the things that James White is saying, I don't know that he really is at all.
I think he's just redefining the terms, just as
right.
Dr. Kaiser does.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I just did, and I told Rich about it, I don't know if he passed it along to you, that I spoke on the phone on the radio program that Calvary Chapel has, Every Man an Answer.
Uh-huh.
And I spoke to a man named Brad Smith. Don't know if you've heard of him?
No.
Okay, and Jeff Johnson from Calvary Chapel over in Downey.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to him about predestination, and I wanted to know exactly what their take was on it, or if they would allow a Reformed theologian such as yourself to go and preach in their pulpits. And they said no, but they don't accept, they wouldn't allow a hyper-Calvinist, that's what they call it, a hyper-Calvinist to preach in our pulpits, he says. And I said, so you wouldn't accept a guy like Pastor John MacArthur? And he says, well, I don't know that Pastor John MacArthur is a hyper-Calvinist then. And I said, well, I have a tape of his on election, and believe me, he is a Reformed Calvinist. I don't know what hyper means.
Well, see, that's a term we need to define, because it is very frequently misused. It is thrown at us out of a tremendous amount of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And in essence, what they're attempting to say, a hyper-Calvinist, and my first exposure to the term Calvinist really came in Bible college, and it was to a hyper-Calvinist. This fella sat behind me in chapel. I went to a Christian Bible college, and this person sat behind me in chapel, and one day I was telling him about what we had done the night before in going out and witnessing to Mormons at the Easter pageant. And he just looked at me and said, why do you do that? If they're elect, they're going to get saved. And I looked at him like, what in the world are you talking about? The main hallmark of a hyper-Calvinist is that they are not involved in evangelism. They do not feel there is any responsibility whatsoever, any privilege given to us to be involved in the proclamation of the gospel, that we can just sit back and enjoy our little spiritual lives. And despite that, God's going to save his elect, and that there is no responsibility to be involved in that. And some people attach other things beyond that to hyper-Calvinism, but as I have seen it expressed, and I've seen people live it out, that is the primary element of it, that there is no evangelism. And of course, to call me a hyper-Calvinist is absurd. I mean, mm-hmm. We're in Salt Lake City, we're in Mesa. To call me a hyper-Calvinist and say we just believe we can just sit back and not proclaim the gospel and all the rest of that stuff is absolutely absurd. But the vast majority of people who use the term don't know what it means anyways. And so we need to define that. And of course, one of the things that was confusing about Chosen But Free is that it used the phrase extreme Calvinist, and a lot of people have assumed that extreme Calvinist and hyper-Calvinist are the same thing. Well, extreme Calvinist is a silly phrase anyways. It didn't have any historical basis, and it's really should not be used by anyone. But some people assume that means if you're an extreme Calvinist, that means you're a hyper-Calvinist, so on and so forth. So John MacArthur most definitely does believe in predestination and election, which is the issue they focus upon. Most of them don't even know what the other issues are. They wouldn't even know what some of us reform folks argue about, even amongst ourselves. That's what they would be focusing upon. And so, it is interesting to hear that kind of response. They're going on the basis of a tradition that they have been taught.
But, you know, the interesting thing about it is that as I was talking to them, they told me that they wanted to give me a little pamphlet written by Pastor Chuck Smith called Calvinism, Arminianism, and the Word of God.
Right.
And basically what they were trying to explain is that there are elements of both. You know, of course, that caught me by surprise, you know, exactly which elements of the tulip do you actually accept
right.
myself. But then they had to cut me off because I had to go to the next caller. They sent it to me, and I read it through. And
I think it's on their website. I'm not sure.
I'm sorry?
I think it's on the website because I've read something by Chuck Smith where he comments on each of the points and talks about what's true and what's false about each one.
Right. Well, in the pamphlet that they sent me, he expresses, okay, this is what Calvinists believe. This is what the Arminians believe. This is what we believe now. And
right.
he says that they try to find a balance without going to the extreme because they feel that Arminians water down the sovereignty of God and Calvinists go to extreme by saying that, you know, we don't have a choice.
Right.
And as I was reading that, I understand a little bit better than that, but as I was reading that, I was noticing that I couldn't find exactly where they really deviated. I mean, you may use different words, but you're really saying the same thing. And it seemed to me, I mean, he didn't believe that grace was resistible. I mean, he did believe that grace was resistible. He mm-hmm. didn't believe in the complete and total depravity of man. He didn't believe in complete unconditional election, that it was based solely upon the grace of God. I mean, the only thing that you might say that he agreed with in the pamphlet was the perseverance of the saints, but on a different basis.
Right, right.
So I called him up a second time to try to get a clarification. This was last Monday. And they said to me that, well, you know, they said they couldn't speak for Pastor Chuck Smith. I didn't get a chance to talk to him. But they basically said that that they don't agree with Arminius because James Arminius believed that God predestines people on the basis of him knowing what they would have chosen, when in reality they quoted John 15:16 where it says, you did not choose me, but I chose you. And I'm just going puzzled in my head how they understand that passage. So they're trying to in some way harmonize it and stand in the middle for some mm-hmm. in some unknown reason. And then, you know, it was really brief. They had to go to a break. They let me go, and then after the break, they told me that there were a couple of good books that I could get. One was Chosen But Free by Norman Geisler, and the other was a pamphlet by George Bison.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yep, I hear you. And by the way, that is on the web. I just someone in the chat room just put it up. And it is on the web. If you go to Library Chuck Smith Books, it is there listed on the web. And I'm looking exactly what you were just talking about. And this is what I've looked at before to try to figure out exactly what they're saying. And yes, they try to avoid the crass elements of Arminianism, but in reality, they still hold to the perspective of being synergistic. For example, I'm reading here, it says, we believe that all are sinners and unable by human performance to earn, deserve, or merit salvation.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds real good. And you know what one of the sad things is today is that many evangelicals will read that and go, oh, that's great. You know what? The Council of Trent said that.
The Council of Trent said that?
Of course. The Council of Trent anathematized anyone who would say that apart from God's grace, we can earn anything from God.
Oh, okay. So they're trying to be an Elliot Miller or a Hank Hinnergriff on this.
Well, but what I'm saying is people don't hear. They don't understand why. Why do we emphasize the solas? Well, because the solas say something.
Mm-hmm.
They emphasize something.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you have this this assertion. Well, the unable by human performance to earn, deserve, and merit salvation. In fact, I met with some Mormons just a couple about a week and a half ago. And they said all the same thing. They emphasized the exact same thing. Was, boy, you know, without God's grace. But see, that's what synergism is all about. It goes on to say, we believe that the wages of sin is death, and that apart from God's grace, no one can be saved. Well, apart from God's grace, no one can be saved. Everybody says that. The question is, does God's grace actually save? There's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's not addressed, then they're not addressing the issue, and you can pretty much guess that they're going to come down on the other side, because those who come to understand the doctrines of grace will emphasize those things, and they will emphasize that because they recognize that is the main area of compromise on the part of those who deny it. So it's not there. You can say that mankind is clearly fallen and lost in sin all you want until you say what that means. You're not really getting anywhere at that point.
Right.
So you look through election, you look through atonement, you look through grace and all these things. You know, the last line under grace. Clearly, God's grace can either be resisted or received by the exercise of human free will. There you go. There you go. Pure semi-Pelagian synergism, exactly on that level, exactly like Rome. Now, of course, Rome then uses all sorts of other issues as to how grace is dispensed, but it's still human synergism. And,
well, can I ask you something about Rome?
Sure.
Because, you know, you speak a lot about anachronisms and things like that about the Roman Catholic Church, and it seems to me that when I look at the common everyday Roman Catholic apologist that I listen to on the radio or whenever I listen to some of their tapes or books or whatever, that they speak of, you know, terms like anathema or in the Catholic Church, and they read, they understand them the way the Second Vatican Council interprets them, that, you know, no one can be saved outside the Catholic Church. That means that unless you don't have to necessarily have a formal communion, you can have an informal communion with the Catholic Church and still be saved, including atheists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're anathema, that doesn't mean you're going to hell. It just means you're excommunicated. But I'm wondering, and I haven't read Roman Catholic apologists of the centuries past.
Right.
And I don't know, maybe you have, maybe you haven't. How did they express the meaning of the anathemas and all of that stuff?
Well, yeah, there's obviously been a tremendous shift over time. I mean, remember, Roman Catholic apologists of the past lived in an age where they defended the faith within a culture where their opponents would be put to death. So they're always responding more to a people outside the specific area where the Roman Catholic Church holds sway. For example, after the Reformation, they're responding to people in Protestant countries. While they don't really have any opponents in their own country at that point in time, because their opponents would be imprisoned, deprived of their liberty, tortured, or put to death. So obviously that has a huge impact upon the issue of what anathema meant. Because everyone knows that when Jan Hus was anathematized by the Council of Constance in the second decade of the 15th century, that the result of that anathematization was his being turned over to the secular authorities to be burned. But
the way Tim said it on the Bible Answerman is that they believe that he was excommunicated and then took him to the secular authorities, and they felt that heretics should be killed. What I'm asking is...
That's absurd. First of all, that is absolutely positively absurd. Those secular authorities had no choice. If they did not bring about the death of that person, they themselves be brought up uncharged and themselves burned. It is absolutely one of the most inane, ridiculous excuses ever thought up by the human mind, that, oh, the Catholic Church had nothing to do with that. It was just the secular. They knew what was going to happen. They were the ones in control. Their own popes at the time preached that the religious authority was superior to the secular authority. That is absolutely ridiculous. It truly is.
I do understand that, but what I'm wondering is that was there any Roman Catholic that existed back then that actually made that distinction, or was that a given?
Distinction between what?
Anathema and you're going to hell.
the phrase going to hell, no. I mean, just think about it in the context of the Council of Constance, I'm sorry, the Council of Florence's statement that Jews, heretics, and schismatics cannot possibly get eternal life. The given was that outside of the sacraments and grace of the church, everyone was going to hell. Therefore, the real issue was who's going to heaven.
And the only way you can get to heaven is through the sacraments of the church. No way you can have the sacraments of the church, of course, is if you're in fellowship with the church and you're under the authority of the church. So the real emphasis was more upon it's a given that everybody is on a bobsled to hell. The issue is, how do you get off that bobsled? And the only way to do that is through faithful adherence to the teachings of the church and the sacraments of the church. So that becomes the issue. The issue of trying to defend that, and then the change that eventually takes place leading to what we have today, that takes place over time, and it takes place only after the Reformation. But up to that point, extra ecclesiam nulla salus very clearly involved the understanding on the part of the people that outside of the grace channeled through the sacraments of the church, there was no salvation. And I don't know of anybody who had a different viewpoint than that at all, but that's certainly the viewpoint that the church held. And that has, of course, changed over time to where you have the vast majority of theologians today who are dabbling with, a large portion of theologians in Roman Catholicism today who are dabbling with universalism. So, that's the whole issue there. So, all righty, sir?
All righty. Are you going to be debating any guy on this issue anymore?
I'm sorry?
In the recent future, because I remember I spoke to your daughter on the chat room, and she told me that you weren't going to be debating George Bryson.
I don't know. I mean, the issue has been raised possibly doing something maybe even on the Bible Answer Man in regards to the CRI journals, but nothing has been mentioned to me at all. I mentioned a couple weeks ago Dave Hunt doesn't seem quite as excited about the debate issue that he once did. And I don't know what's coming up as far as debates go. All righty?
All right.
Okay, thanks for calling.
God bless.
All right, God bless. Bye-bye. Alrighty, that'll do it for the dividing line. Whoa. That will do it for the dividing line today, and for whoever was just doing that particular hang up and handling the controls. Next week, no discussion of Norman Geisler or Chosen But Free will be allowed. We will actually talk about something else, because it's obvious that's what you want to talk about as well. So we'll be here next week. If you'll be here next week, maybe we'll be able to continue the possibility of my singing next week here on The Dividing Line, but probably not. See you then. Bye.